Hi, this is Imran from Real Bible Stories. I just wanted to get on here real quick. I know that we just started this series with Pastor David on heaven, but he got really busy at the beginning of 2024. So we're actually going to be coming to you with this great, great episode from Pastor Ryan Brown, because now we got him back from the holiday period. So I hope you really enjoy this episode. It is definitely one of my favorites, and it's definitely maturing the view that you had on this Bible story. Hope you enjoy.
Hello and welcome to Real Bible Stories. Join us as we deep dive into the historic, religious, cultural, political, and emotional context surrounding the real lives of real people in the Bible and the stories we've all grown to love.
Hello and welcome back to Real Bible Stories. I am your host, Imran Ward, and we're joined by my wife, Selena.
Hello.
And our teacher for today, Pastor Ryan Brown.
Hello,
welcome
everyone.
Welcome back.
I know. Yeah. I'm so excited.
And happy New Year's, everybody.
Yeah. It's been such a journey in terms of like everywhere we've been over the last few weeks. Selena and I just came back from a trip to Miami, where we're both from, for the holiday period. And Ryan, what were you doing for Christmas? Were you just around here?
Yeah, we stayed pretty local. We went up to Flagstaff for did the Polar Express and did some hiking up in...
The Polar Express.
Yeah.
What is that?
It's in Williams. It's awesome. It's pretty much just a train ride that goes from Williams up to this little Santa North Pole town and back down. And they do sing Christmas carols and hot chocolate and all that.
That's super cute.
So cute. So
but they got Arizona there. My favorite zoo's there. We go there every time we go. It's like one of those drive-through zoos.
Do you have to take a train to get to it?
No. This is like right... about 5 minutes outside of the town of Williams, Arizona, but you show up and it's just like, it's kind of like Jurassic Park. The doors open up and you go driving through and then it's just all the bears and wolves and you're just driving along with them and it's a good time.
That's so interesting.
Did the deer farm and then went up to Flagstaff and did some hiking and we had a good holiday.
Yeah,
got to see a lot
like
of snow
time.
And
yeah, that does sound like a good time. All right. Awesome. Awesome.
But I missed you all. I was telling Imran when he came to pick me up that, man, I feel like I haven't seen you guys in like forever.
Yeah. Because we just kind of ended up not crossing paths as often. You know, like Selena went to the meeting yesterday, but I didn't actually go to church yesterday because I was over at the Protestant chapel working on things. But we're all here now. We're all here together. Now we're going to learn about the word of God together.
Amen.
And so we're going into the story of David and Goliath today.
Yeah, I think it'd be a good one for us to kick off. You know, in the beginning... when we first started this whole podcast, and I think it was when you guys had just shown up at the church.
Yeah, I think we'd only been there about 6 months or so.
Yeah.
By the first December, I think is when I brought it up to you. And yeah, I showed up in like July, June timeframe.
And in that time, I was doing a Bible study series called Real Bible Stories, right? Yeah. Which was taking some of the most common stories in your Bible and kind of maturing them for adults. Because we had always received these, you know, versions of the story that were kind of for Sunday school.
Easy, right? Easy to color in a coloring book.
Right. You don't really, like, we don't talk about why Goliath was beheaded and dismembered after the battle. And you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You don't talk about that with kids.
Some people right now are like, oh, he was?
yeah, just wait. So the whole premise was trying to mature some of those most common stories. But the other thing, and functionally, I've seen two kind of responses to these Bible stories and podcasts is one, people, they absolutely love it. I think when they get some of the more of the depth where it's just beyond
the
like
nuance.
Beyond just a story.
It just makes it more real. You know?
And so they enjoy it, but some of them, they're like, yeah, but you also kind of ruin that story in the sense that, you know, their entire life, you know, they had this
rose tinted.
Yeah. This view of what that story was and what was going on. And it kind of like completely reforms and reframes it a bit. And a lot of the reason, and we're going to see that tonight, which is why I'm kind of leading into that, is that, you know, these stories, you know, particularly the really popular, well, all of them, but, you know, the popular ones, they're not told in a vacuum, right? Mm-hmm. Like the point of communicating that story isn't just simply to let you know, hey, there was this really cool battle between this warrior called Goliath and this shepherd boy named David, right?
Yeah.
Like it's in there to a larger point. And typically the way these stories are taught or preached or you know, if it's taught in Sunday school, it's really just that story. If you're preaching it, even most sermons are about 30 to 40 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have a whole lot of time to get into all the intricacies.
The nuance of like how warfare works. Why were they at that battle in the first place? Well, what happened after that battle?
And how it sits within the literary context of that book, right? That any one of those stories is pulling in multiple themes, motifs, and ideas that have probably been introduced before and are reinforced after, but that are ultimately leading to a larger point that is never always made. So we just kind of make, you know, pull the story out and get some points from that. But you know what I mean? It's incomplete.
And no, I totally get you.
Yeah. So we're going to be doing that. We're going to be taking first starting kind of like at a 30,000 foot view of this story that kind of leads into it, because, you know, it's, you have to really understand the real story behind David and Goliath and why it was significant, why it was included. We really need to understand the problem, what was going on, right?
Yeah, and I absolutely agree. For those that have been listening to the more recent episodes, like if you listen to our episode on the Red Sea crossing, I didn't even think about that happening at night. Like something that's like very clearly written in the scripture. Every time I had to draw it in a coloring book as a kid, I drew a sunshine in the sky, or there was already sunshine there for me to color
in the sun.
But it's like that happened at night under cover of darkness. You had a pillar, they were being led by a pillar of flame that then went behind them and blinded the Egyptians from being able to see the Israelites cross. And there was the light on one side and darkness on the other. So they were confused. And it's like, wow, that is very...
Well, like, and that's going to actually feed into another concept we talk about with David and Goliath that was applied to that story as well. So that's actually a good good anchor for us to maybe fall back on too, to discuss
later.
Because, we'll take it in due time, because there's actually a lot to chew here. So let me
one bite at a time.
Yeah, well, let's first start off with 1 Samuel in the book that this story sits in. We're going to be in 1 Samuel 17. And 1 Samuel as a book itself, if I can maybe just summarize it this way, what was the problem? What was going on? This story sits underneath the larger point of 1 Samuel, which is that it's trying to address generational failure.
Interesting.
Particularly among adults.
Now, just for my mind, 1 Samuel is after Judges, right?
Correct.
It's been a while since I've done Bible drill.
Yeah, that is absolutely
so it. We have all of the stuff that happened in the book of Judges.
It flows. And now Judges flows right into.
Because Judges is all of that generational failure with the judge being risen. And then how did it go? It's like the people are given the sign. They turn to God and then they start turning away from God. A judge is risen up. And
unfaithfulness, right.
Mm-hmm. And
we're going to refer to that here in a bit because... So it's speaking to a generational failure, but particularly a generational failure of adults, but specifically men.
Mm-hmm.
So to your judge's point, right? Which is also generational failure.
Yeah.
And the idea is that God had made a promise to them, but they also had to be faithful back. They had to go clear the land of Canaan, or Cana, to clear out of all the inhabitants and be faithful, right?
But they weren't doing that.
They started to with Joshua. They kind of made these little strongholds within the land, but they never finished the job, right?
Mm-hmm.
So God is wanting to raise up judges to keep them to do, because he's faithful, even if they're unfaithful.
Yeah.
But he does it in ways, though, to show them, and in a sense, I think even give confidence to them.
If I remember correctly, it was Samson that, through his actions, actually triggered the war with the Canaanites that ultimately got the Canaanites driven out.
Right. So to put it across, and we're not going to go through all the judges, but like if you look at Deborah, okay. So as a good example is, particularly in this culture, women were not expected to take up arms and fight wars.
Mm. Yeah.
Let alone lead armies to be the general. But because the men were failing to do it, he says, I'm still going to accomplish what I want to accomplish, but I'm not going to raise up a man. I'm going to raise up a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to show that I can use anybody to accomplish what I want, right?
Yeah,
there's another story, another judge, Ehud, who was a cripple. Like it says, essentially, forgot the name of it, but it's when your bones kind of contract in and it kind of makes your...
Mm. Oh, man.
Like it makes your...
I do know what you're talking about.
And arm kind of cripple in. Yeah, you know what I mean? I forgot what it's called, but... But you have Ehud, who's this cripple, and he ends up going and executing and assassinating one of the Canaanite kings. Mm. So he's showing them, like, men, if you're not going to do it, I will even raise up the crippled, and they're going to be able to accomplish my will, right? You get to Samson, who's a psychopath. It's like, okay, men, if you're not going to do it, I'm going to raise psychopaths, and I'm going to use them to my good to stir up so much chaos that will force you to go to war to be faithful with what you're supposed to do, right? So 1 Samuel is kind of an extension of that, right? Is that here they're in war against the Philistines because of the chaos that Samson had raised up. They're finally at war, but they're still not really fully mature in their faith of what they were supposed to be doing. In 1 Samuel, you have 100 and I have it written down here. Oh, the term men or man is used 161 times in the book.
In 1 Samuel. Okay.
And that is more than any other book in the Bible.
Oh, wow.
So there is the heaviest emphasis on men in 1 Samuel. And the one that comes in number two is 2 Samuel with 140 instances of men
being used.
So there's this emphasis, like it's meant to be a manly book, right? Yeah. In a sense, and you kind of get that sense when you read it because there's a lot of combat. There's a lot of war, right? Like if you were to make a movie of this book of the Bible, it's like, it would be a guy movie, right? Like
it would just be, oh man. What is that quintessential movie about the Roman battle?
500?
No, but that's great too. That could be
300?
300, not 500. You're right.
I've never been good with numbers.
Those were the Spartans. Those weren't the Romans. But
that's not.
But yeah, like even the guy movie, like Braveheart. And, you know, that's the kind of movie 1 Samuel would be. So it's meant to appeal to men. It's meant to be one of those kind of books, right? And even more so, there's also this comparison between men and the youth. Mm. So you got adults and men, then you got boys, youth. That's another one that's the only other book that actually ties for with Genesis for the most used term of the word youth or boy or somebody who's like an adolescent.
That's interesting that Genesis uses that term that much.
And that, well, that's because most of Genesis is talking about a family, right? Oh. From Abraham all the way through. And so anyways, my point being is that what you're really talking about is this generational failure and leading into the story with David, and fighting Goliath is that and a lot of people miss the tragedy of this story, which is that here is David at this particular time is anywhere between the ages of probably 13 and 16 years old. Okay. Having to go fight a battle that all of the men of his generation should have fought, but refused to fight. Mm-hmm. So not only did they allow a child to fight their fight for him, they encouraged him. They even tried to equip him and they allow him to go out alone. Hmm. Right. So like, we're going to get into it here in a second, but even when it speaks of Goliath showing up to this fight, he has a shield bearer with him. Nobody even went out with David.
Wow.
To go fight this fight. So you're talking about how embarrassing that is for a man to be reading this and be like, wow, like there was not a single man who was willing to step up and do what he needed to do. Instead, we needed our children to fight this fight. And I think like that point in itself, when we start thinking about a generation is that, yeah, I would say, I would even argue in our current generation, you can find plenty of examples where we are expecting our youth to fight fights that the adults should be fighting. And because adults aren't taking responsibility for the fights they should be fighting, that's why you start seeing like culturally, politically, all these things start targeting the youth.
A lot of these,
because they're saying, if that's who's going to fight your fights, that's who we're going to target. So they're going after junior high school, college students.
The current generation. I mean, you can look at the biggest name protests that you see right now. A lot of them are primarily, it's the young people out there protesting. It's not those that are, you know, older or in power or anything like that. It's like, it's the high school, college generation. Like they're out there on the streets trying to get something to change because, well, they expect those in power to be handling whether or not.
And they have all the zeal, but none of the experience, none of the education yet. So this is why you start seeing this powder keg of just nonsense, right? And they're also going to push things that because they're also more naive. So they're going to believe certain things quicker or without challenge, or maybe they're like, I'm not sure that's right, but they don't feel confident enough yet. Yeah. and what they know or can do. That's why adults need to step in and say, no, that's nonsense.
Yeah.
Let me.
Here are the long-term ramifications of.
Right. Let me step in and be an adult in this situation instead of letting you continue to fight this alone.
Here's a little statistic that I heard recently in an advertisement. It was for a dating application. And they said that it was something like 58%, maybe 60% of young people of Gen Z, millennials are comfortable dating multiple people at the same time. And this app was marketing that, like, we make it really easy and convenient for you to be able to date multiple people at one time. And I was like, why is that something that is
marketable?
Like, yeah, exactly. And it's like, what are we doing as adults, as Christians, to help inform people that that is not a healthy way? There is not long-term success in that strategy, right? There are a lot of long-term ramifications. That's not going to be in your best interest if you continue down this path.
Yeah. Right. And how does that translate though to, well, how do adults fight the fight that children are fighting? It's like, well, that means having the fights with your children sometimes.
Yeah.
Like, hey, I know you're 16, but no social media. And if I catch you on social media, I'm taking your phone, right? Like, who wants to have that fight with their teenager? Mm-hmm. But sometimes you have to, because you see the effects of it.
You know, this new generation right now at people 2 and under, they're called Generation Alpha. That's termed now, Generation Alpha. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because we got one through Z, so we're back to A.
Yeah, so because you go into the Greek, now we're in the Greek alphabet. So Generation Alpha is also nicknamed iPad kids because of the lack of involvement of their parents and just being perfectly comfortable giving them the iPad and letting them be taught by Apple and taught by these tablet makers on how to be, and taught by YouTube Kids on how to be a kid instead of actually being involved in your kids' lives. So,
well, we went through this as a family because we... Like we've saw it and we have put an end to it. Right. But there is a thing when you have that toddler or whoever's throwing a temper tantrum, a benefit that my generation has with parenting, that if anybody older, like who was not part of that iPad age when they had children, would say that that's just ridiculous. Like, they would have done the exact same thing. You know what I mean? If your kids are losing your mind and you're like, hey, here, just watch this video, right? To entertain them, and they get it. It calms them down.
Yeah. Know?
So now I'm not embarrassed in the restaurant anymore.
But the reverse is also true. Because I remember seeing at the wedding that we were trying to take this picture of the ring bearer. And he's like, you know, like 2 years old or whatever. And he was on the iPad and they took it away from him and he just screamed.
Yeah, it turns into that.
And they gave it back to him and he was completely quiet. And they were like, but we need to take this picture. And they took it away from him and he just screamed. Goodness. It took them like 20 minutes to calm this kid down.
Well, after they took this thing away from him. And we saw that too. And that's why we removed it.
Yeah,
we did that fight and we said, yeah, they're not going to be happy for a couple of days, but we removed YouTube. We removed that, right? Because we saw the effects it was having.
Yeah,
that we had become undisciplined, not really thinking through
the long-term effects, right,
that,
of this.
The habit this could build and what this could do to them. But, you know, that's sometimes like the fight you need to fight. And if you don't fight that fight, then you're letting all these other sources, right?
Yeah.
Come in and
corporations, so, schools, friends, government coming in and mentoring your kid when you should be there teaching your kid.
Right. So the first point of this is that the story of David and Goliath sits within this literary context of talking about a generational failure of men refusing to be men, allowing children to fight fights that the adults should be fighting, right? All to accomplish what Israel was supposed to be doing in terms of their faithfulness to what God had told them, right? So that's one. The second thing is, I think, and this is, right, real Bible stories, right? This is a misnomer. But we always call this, whenever you think of David and Goliath, what do you think of? Giants.
Mm-hmm.
Defeating your giants, right?
Yeah.
Conquering your giants.
Who are the Goliaths in your life?
Yeah, giants.
How it's to like, be a David?
No one ever calls him a giant. That is something that is just subsumed onto the text. And it's
doesn't call him a giant?
No.
What?
It does not. Sure doesn't.
Oh snap.
Yeah. So is it just because
we'll get to it.
Okay.
Because we're gonna have to read the text first.
Yeah, we are gonna get into it. But why don't we first actually do that? Let's read the go ahead and tell me what are we gonna start in verse 4 and go through what? Verse 11.
This is 1 Samuel 17.
And we're gonna be all across 1 Samuel 17, 16, like really across the entire book, but this will be a good anchor text for us to
start off.
And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs, and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron. And his shield bearer went before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine, and are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves, and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid.
Okay, so that acts as a good anchor, okay? Now, notice nowhere in there it calls him a giant, okay?
Well, what is 6 cubits and a
so span? So we'll talk about that here in a second, because...
And a span.
Yeah, that's interesting metrics, right?
Yeah.
But I first want to kind of make this point, which is... based off of the intention of the writer, when you follow the way what the author is trying to communicate in terms of 1 Samuel and what he is introducing, if you're going to call Goliath a giant, you really then have a story of 4 giants. There's really 4 giants that the author presents in this story. And he really emphasizes 3 elements for each one of them. Okay. So let me first name the 4 giants, okay? Mm-hmm. So you have Goliath, who's the champion of the Philistines, okay? The second is you have Eliab, who is David's older brother, okay? That's the second giant that is emphasized in 1 Samuel. The third is King Saul, and the fourth ultimately ends up being David, okay? Now, this is what he's comparing, okay? This is the contrast, and this is what the author is, I think, trying to communicate to us. There's 3 things that are emphasized with each one of these men. The first is their stature. Okay. So first here we see with Goliath is what he is,
9 cubits and a shekel or sorry, nine
six,
cubits.
6 cubits in a span.
6 cubits in a span.
So he's 6 cubits in a span. So, as a metric, what that would translate to us is, around 9'9" to 9'11". So people make this leap of, okay, that means he's a giant because that's ridiculously tall,
quite a height.
Now, here's the thing, and this is going to rock some people's boats, okay? But the oldest recorded document we have of this story comes out of the Septuagint. Now, the Septuagint was the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when the Greeks came and took over Alexander the Great, established the Library of Alexandria. And what had happened is all the great scribes, all the great rabbis of the day met at Alexandria and they translated the Hebrew Bible into Greek.
Okay.
So the oldest document we have of this story comes from the Septuagint. There is, and I say that because in the Septuagint, which is the oldest we have, it does not list Goliath as being 9'9" to 9'11", 6 cubits in a span.
Mm-hmm.
And instead says that he's 4 cubits in a span.
Oh, really?
Which puts him about 6'9" to 6'11", which is still really tall.
Yeah.
But it's not like freakishly tall.
Yeah. Right? Shaquille O'Neal is over 7 feet tall.
Right. Mm-hmm. And Goliath would have towered over him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So if he was 9'9", why is it then that the older document?
I think Shaquille O'Neal is the tallest man I'm aware of. It's like a, but I don't think he's the tallest man. I think
he's not the tallest currently man alive.
No. I think it's a Chinese guy,
but still tall. Like I think you're looking at about 7'11" is probably.
Mm-hmm.
So the point being is that why does it place him around 6'9", 6'11" in the older documents, but in the newer, why does that get exaggerated, right? Because the oldest Hebrew document we have, which is about 200 years older, puts him at 9'9", 9'11".
Okay.
Well, so hold on.
We'll, I just want to make sure I clarify, because you said the oldest document we have of this story was the Greek one.
Is the Septuagint?
The Septuagint.
Which was the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible when all the rabbis met together in Alexandria and translated it over to Greek.
So you said 200 years older though, but this other
the oldest example, Hebrew document.
One is 200 years younger.
No, than, older. Older.
So even older than the Greek one.
Right. So the earliest document we have of this is the Greek Septuagint translation, which has him at 6'9", 6'11".
Yeah. But the Hebrew one is, it wouldn't be older, it'd be younger. It'd be 200 years younger.
No, older.
How is the oldest one?
The oldest Hebrew version of this story we have is, when I say older, I'm sorry. I think I understand your confusion. The old Septuagint is older than the oldest Hebrew document we have of this story.
Okay.
Right?
So the Greek one is 200 years older than the Hebrew one.
Correct. Yes.
The Hebrew one is slightly younger.
Yes, gotcha. Yes.
Yes. That's what I'm saying. Like, it can't be 200 more years. That's not how English works.
Yeah, no, I know. Yeah, I see what you're saying. Yes. Yeah. So, but the point is that
I'm just making sure. So the Hebrew one's younger, the Greek one's older, but the Greek one's a translation of an older Hebrew version.
Correct.
Okay.
That has him shorter, right?
Yeah, that has him shorter.
So to Selena's question.
But we latched on to that oldest Hebrew version, which is 200 years younger than the Greek translation.
Right. And to Selena's question was, why is that? Because in the time of that, at least the oldest Hebrew document we have, that's when they were being ruled by the Greeks. So you have to kind of understand religious rivalry, okay? If the Greeks are in charge, what religion is now starting to take over and be culturalized within the region of Israel?
Does the Greek religion have a name?
Yeah, I mean, well, they have their pantheon, right? Oh, okay. Zeus and Apollo and, okay. Right? So the Greek pantheon of gods is starting to go into the culture, right?
Okay.
The Greek religion, you know, they had... you know, all these stories and myths of these heroes going to slay these massive giants and creatures, right?
Odysseus slaying the...
There's these big epics. They call them epics, right? Mm-hmm. These big epics. So part of what many think is that they kind of change some of the details to make it sound a little bit more like a Greek epic to get people kind of focused on...
Cyclops.
Right. And you see a lot of instances of this across the Bible, and we'll talk a little bit more about this later. It's called polemics, but but when we talk in like reality, right, in terms of what we know by the oldest document that we have, Goliath is probably more 6'9", 6'11". Big dude, really tall, but not like this. You know,
so it's still like an impressive tall, right? Height, because if not, they wouldn't have written it.
Correct. Like this guy, he's impressively tall, but he is not...
giant supernatural
right.
type of
supernatural tall.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but notice though that the first thing, right, is that it emphasizes his stature, right? Mm-hmm. This is how big he is. This is how tall he is. He's athletic. He's a champion, right?
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is his experience. So you see this in verse 4 there when it uses the term champion, right? To be a champion means you are experienced in warfare. You are not you know, you are not a
novice.
Exactly. Like this isn't a David coming up, right? This is somebody who's experienced in war.
Mm-hmm.
So it emphasizes stature, experience, and the third was equipment, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the rest of that whole slew of text that you read, notice how it goes in explaining the type of armor he has.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is going to become really relevant when we start talking about the battle itself, but there's this huge emphasis on the equipment that Goliath had. So you got a guy who's big in stature, who is experienced, and who is very well equipped.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? So there's that big emphasis for him. Now, again, back to the Septuagint, it mentions his equipment, but it doesn't provide the same details of equipment that's was provided later in the Hebrew document. So, like, talking about how much his shield weighed and things like that.
Those bronze.
Right. The original talks more to, and he had all this this weaponry and equipment with him. He's well equipped.
Mm-hmm.
In their day, that would have been a big deal, because it's not like modern militaries where, all right,
everyone gets the same equipment.
You go to SIF and check out your PPE, right?
Yeah.
Like, for you to go to war, and we're going to talk about this when we get into the second giant here, which is Eliab.
Mm.
You were kind of expected to source your own equipment to go to war with.
It's like even as recent, but like in the Revolutionary War, that was one of the conditions of joining the army, was to bring your own rifle. Mm-hmm. All right. And joining the Marine Corps was bring your own rifle. So that was like, you have to have a rifle already if you're going to join. We don't have rifles for you.
Right. Yeah. Again, it's expected you bring your own equipment. Yeah. So, and that goes into the second one here, which is Eliab, who is David's family, right? It's his oldest brother. And if you were to back up one chapter, in chapter 16, I think it's, let's see, verse 6-7, it mentions, so the prophet Samuel is showing up because he's wanting to anoint the next king, right? He's kind of doing this behind Saul's back. So he comes to Jesse, who has all his sons, David being the youngest of those sons. But it says that it mentions, did you turn there?
Yeah.
So, you know, you want to read it, verses 6-7?
When they came, he looked on Eliab. How do you say that?
Eliab.
Eliab. And thought, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. But the Lord said to Samuel, do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart.
Right. So notice the emphasis there, though. And we're going to get to the looks at the heart here in a second. But the first piece, it says, don't look about how tall he is and how big he is. Right. So it emphasizes the height of Goliath, but it also, the author emphasizes the height of Eliab, right? And why is that? Well, why Eliab? And because it later tells us that Eliab was the one who went to war on behalf of that family.
Yeah.
The whole reason David shows up to the battle is to deliver cheese and bread to his brothers who went ahead to fight. Does that make sense? So you have his older brother who is there, big in stature, right? Experience, let's see, verse 13 emphasizes the experience of Eliab. The equipment, kind of like we were just talking about, was assumed going into battle, right?
Yeah.
So he had the equipment, he had the experience, he had the stature, his older brother. But the Lord rejected him, right? So here you have Goliath, huge stature, experience, equipment. Here you have Eliab, stature, experience, equipment. Then you get to Saul, okay? So in 1 Samuel chapter 9, verses 1-2, it also emphasizes the stature of King Saul. Do you have it in mind?
I do.
You want to read it?
So 1 Samuel chapter 9, verse 1 and 2, there was a man of the tribe of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, son of Zeror. Man, you got me with this one. Son of Becheroth, and the son of Apihai, a Benjamite, a mighty man of influence and wealth. Kish had a son named Saul, a choice and handsome man. Among the sons of Israel, there was not a man more handsome than he. From his shoulders and up, he was a head taller than any of the people.
So what does it emphasize there again? Height, right?
Stature.
So his stature. So King Saul had stature. He was taller than everybody. He was bigger than everybody. He had the stature. Really, it is an inferred understanding, but in terms of combat experience, when you read from chapters 13 all the way leading into this fight with Goliath, there are just stories after story of Saul fighting battles.
Yeah.
Right. You're learning.
And he's not dead, so he's winning.
Right. You're learning and experiencing combat with Saul as you kind of read through that book, right? Mm-hmm. So you already know. It's already assumed.
How's that not a Netflix series already?
I know, right? But then the third was his equipment. So if you remember, if we were to keep reading out of 1 Samuel 17, David will eventually step forward to fight Goliath. And it says immediately what Saul begins to do is to dress David in his armor, right? So because to them, and we'll get to this in a second when we get to David, David didn't have stature. Yeah. He didn't have the experience and he didn't have equipment. So he's like, well, at least the least we could do is give you equipment. And King Saul, being the king, probably had the best equipment of everybody in the army.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So I'll at least give you some good equipment to go fight with, right? And then eventually, you know, David rejects it and says, I can't move in this. Like,
it's far too much.
This is not built for me, because remember, he's bigger than everybody. And but see how it's emphasizing those three elements for each one of them, right?
Yeah.
So they're all pretty much the same. They're all tall. They're all big. They're all well experienced in war, and they're all well equipped, right? Then you get to David, right? And this is what the author's kind of leading everybody to by comparison of those three things. Now, what does it say of David's stature, right? So one, it says that he was handsome. It says that he was, it uses this term essentially that he was like a redhead who was like blushing, but he was very, like baby like
youthful. Yeah.
Yeah. Baby faced. Yeah. And so, okay. Handsome. It probably would have made the girls go gaga. Right. But mm-hmm. not as, and you see
not
this
that rugged
when you get to, back to chapter 17, right. When David comes forward to fight Goliath, he actually gets offended. This is what he says. He said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by the gods. "Come here," he said, "I'll give your flesh to the birds and the wild animals." But what led all to that, because in verse 42, he says, he looked David over and saw that he was a little more than a boy, glowing with health and handsome, and he despised him, right? So the point is that what it emphasizes with David is that, yeah, like he may have been good looking, but he did not have the stature of a warrior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. He was not, he did not have the height. He wasn't big.
Yeah.
He's just this youthful, you know, heartthrob essentially.
Yeah.
And Goliath is just like, this is ridiculous. He was so offended. Right.
Yeah. So he's an Edward.
Right. But what does it say about his stature? So this goes back to when Samuel came to anoint the next king. He looks at Eliab and he's like, "Don't look at his stature. Don't look how tall he is or how handsome he is. The Lord is not with him." Mm-hmm. But then he gets to David, because then there's this whole story of, "Well, I got my youngest still. He's out in the fields," and they're like, "We'll bring him in." And Samuel sees him. But if you remember, Samuel says, "Man looks at outward appearance, but God looks at what?
The heart."
The heart.
The heart. Mm-hmm. And then the Bible later says, talks about how David was a man after God's own heart. Okay. Right. So the first thing that it emphasizes in terms of stature, it's not the stature of the body, it's the stature of your heart, mm-hmm. right? When it comes to this fight. So David had the stature. It just wasn't the stature that the world looks at when it comes to making decisions, right? Mm-hmm. And we do that even today, right? We tend to think, you know, I think David very easily could have fell into the same temptation of when he goes to fight Goliath. It's like, well, I'm not big. Look how massive that dude is, right? Look at all these other bigger dudes with higher stature around me. They can go fight it, right? They should go fight this guy. Like, why am I the one who's going to go
even
fight
his own brother who's
right?
there?
Right. Like, and his own brother let him, right? Like, could you imagine that even as an older brother? Like, yeah, I'll let you go out there and fight. Because you know what I'm saying?
Like, all right, bet.
Like, you want to do that as an older brother, especially if you have the stature, quote unquote stature, right? But the author makes the point, the stature that David had was the stature of his heart, right? To approach this.
Yeah.
Well, what did he have in terms of experience? Well, one, there was two things. One of the things that David had said to Saul when he showed up is that he talks about how he wasn't necessarily a man at war, but he had battled beasts to protect his flock, right? That is making a ploy, though, again, from the anointing that Samuel had given him, is that, hey, I'm stepping into this to be the flock of Israel, or to fight for the flock of Israel. Just as I was a shepherd for my father's sheep, I will be a shepherd to these people. So one of the things that's kind of interesting about that is that there's this probably whole political thing going on with this. Hmm. There may be a reason that Jesse had sent David to go deliver milk and cheese at the front lines to his brothers. David being anointed by Samuel, that was obviously on his mind.
Oh, yeah, that all happened beforehand.
Right. So he was probably showing up like, so the high priest of Israel has anointed me to be the next guy. I don't know what that means.
Oh, and David would have known that this happened.
Right, because he had to lay hands on and anoint him, right?
I wonder how old he was.
But that's what I'm saying. He was a teenager.
Oh, he was. No, I mean, when the anointing happened, but that's a separate.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he could even, I mean, obviously at the point of the fight, he was between 13
and 16.
And 16, right? So let's say,
anyone's guess.
Liberally, he was 16 years old and he was around 13, right?
But he was already, by the time he got anointed, he was already a shepherd, though, because I remember they had to call him back to the field.
He had already been a shepherd.
He was old enough to have responsibility in that way. So,
but remember, Saul didn't know this happened. Samuel did this kind of quietly, right? Mm. So when David shows up, then he sees a wolf, right? Threatening Israel, and he doesn't see any of the men come to step forward. Much of this could have also been a sense of responsibility from David and saying, well, if I'm really going to be the shepherd of Israel at some point, like apparently through God's high priest told me, then I need to go be a shepherd. I need to go fight the ravenous wolf, right?
Yeah.
So he's one drawing on experience, not as a man of war, but as a shepherd. And that's what Israel needs is a shepherd, mm-hmm. to shepherd the people, right? So that's one piece. But the piece that is directly, I think, even more relevant to the larger point of Samuel, for Samuel, and what is directly in the text itself, and it's kind of a clue, but in verse 26, you know, so for days, Goliath is coming out and mocking Israel,
yeah.
Particularly mocking Israel's God. He's mm-hmm. mocking Yahweh, right? He's mocking their God and shaming them every single day, because every single time, like this is in verse, 22, David left his things with the keeper of supplies, ran to the battle lines and asked his brothers how they were. As he was talking with them, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, stepped out from his lines and shouted his usual defiance, and David heard it, okay? Whenever the Israelites saw the man, they all fled from him in great fear. So over and over, he keeps talking about the fear of Israel, the fear mm-hmm. of these men.
I think that is absolutely wild. It says over there in verse 16 that Goliath came out morning and evening and took his stand for 40 days.
Twice wow. a day for 40 days. Think about yeah. that. So over and over, he's just mocking God. And this is going to be our final point. That feeds into our final point of what this big story really is, I think.
Yeah.
But we'll save it, right? One bite at a time. But going into this, though, so David hears this, right? Verse 26, David asked the men standing near him, what will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Right? Because then he continues, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?
Man, I remember when we did the Crossing of the Red Sea episode, that like the roasts that are in the Old Testament are just like top notch. Like I love the insults. Okay, like if someone walked up to me and was like, you uncircumcised Philistine, I'd be like, yo, what?
but what does that tie you to though? What does that mean? Like think to Israel. Mm-hmm. What was the sign of circumcision?
The part of God's people.
Right. What's that?
The part of God's people.
Right. That was yeah. the covenant sign that you belong under the covenant of God. Mm-hmm. The promises that God has made that people, this is the sign that you belong to that, right? It was meant to be yeah. a sign to remind you, I'm in covenant with Yahweh, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So by him going out and saying, who is this guy to come mock the armies of the living God, this uncircumcised dude, this dude who is outside of this promise?
Yeah.
Why are we letting this guy who God has not made a promise to mock the people he has made a promise to? In other words, what he ultimately shows up to battle with, he has a stature of heart, but then he has the experience, not of self, but the experience of Israel.
Yeah.
He says, do you guys not remember the Exodus? Do you remember the Red Sea? Do you remember? There's another big thing that had happened prior in 1 Samuel that we'll talk about here in a second, but he's drawing on the experiences of Israel and what God has done for them. He says, we're the ones who have the promise. We're the ones God is with. He is approaching the fight through the experience of God in Israel, not the personal experience of war, right?
Yeah.
So he's looking at it holistically in terms of promise and covenant because he has the stature of heart, right? But then he says, what equipment did he come, right? And this is in, verse 45, right? So Goliath is mocking him. You come at me with sticks, right? And the Philistine cursed David.
Was he referring
David.
To David as the stick?
Yes. Yeah.
Tiny dude.
Just these feeble things because he came out not equipped with anything except a sling, uh-huh. right? And we'll talk about that here in a second. But he comes out with a sling. Like, he's like, you're going to come at me with sticks?
Yeah.
Right? Like, who is this, you know, Justin Bieber?
Hey.
You know what I'm saying? Like, who's coming out to fight me with
the
a stick?
The epitome of manliness.
Right? So he starts mocking David, but what does David respond to? But David said to the Philistine, you come against me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, right? Equipment, mm-hmm. right? He's emphasizing yeah. the equipment. But I come against you in the name of the Lord Almighty, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied, right? So when everybody else was like focused on the armor and the weapons yeah. and the height and combat experience, David comes strapped with a stature of heart for God, with the experience of Israel and the name or the character of Yahweh to pin against them.
Yeah.
Which flows into I would say what we call the ultimate point that's kind of being demonstrated here, which is that it's a polemic. Now,
a what?
A polemic. Now, let me explain this, okay? A polemic means a harsh criticism, or what I would just say how it practically plays out in scripture.
Mm-hmm.
It is trash talk.
Oh.
And or if you could say it this way, it's God trolling
the world.
The world. Yeah. it is awesome. And it is everywhere. I've read since I've been on break from the podcast, you guys have been still working.
Yeah.
I have read many books on what you'd call polemic theology. And I've read a lot of books actually.
There's moments where God reaches into creation and just goes like LOL.
So we've talked about this before. If you remember, okay, let's talk about the Christmas story, right? Remember about the star?
Mm-hmm.
We said, well, that's actually probably an astrology play because every constellation was given a region within the Roman Empire.
Yeah.
They see the special star come out within a constellation
mm-hmm.
that hadn't happened since and hasn't happened since.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out within the constellation of Judea. So that's how they looked at the star and said, a king has been born in Judea.
Yeah.
They go to Jerusalem because that's the capital, mm-hmm. looking for this new king, right? That's a play on the astrology beliefs of a pagan society. It was a Gentile belief, right?
Yeah.
So what God, we talked about this with Genesis 1, right? That it's, if you bring in and understand Egyptian creation mythology, Babylonian, mm-hmm. Sumerian mythology of creation, mm-hmm. he is taking essentially the belief systems, but then he plays out their belief systems in history, but to his purpose.
Yeah.
So let me give you a couple examples, okay? Because this is everywhere, and I could just tell you, like, this has been something that I picked up on. I just never had a good construct of understanding,
yeah.
like, categorically what this was, right? And it's called polemics. I found it. That's why I read, like, 10
everything
books,
you find.
Right? Yeah. but, like, a good example. So when Elijah is in his showdown with the priest of Baal, so they're at Mount Carmel, okay. right? There's been a drought over the land. Because Elijah prophesied it. He said, a drought's going to come over the land. And that's what happened. The problem was it went on for 3 years. And Elijah's like, hey, can you stop the drought? Because we're starving, right? So they decide to have the showdown, right? And they build altars on top of Mount Carmel. And he says, whoever the God favors, or whoever's altar he favors, right, is victorious, essentially, right? So, of course, it says that a fire from heaven came down, struck Elijah's altar to Yahweh, then they slayed the 500 prophets of Baal, and that starts this whole thing with Jezebel and King Ahab, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a whole story around it. But what we miss, okay, contextually, is this. The reason Elijah called for a drought is because the god Baal in Canaanite theology was the god of rain and thunder.
Mm.
So by him proclaiming on behalf of Yahweh, there's going to be a drought that is showing Yahweh is more powerful.
Is greater than
Baal, right?
Yeah.
When you then get to the actual fire from heaven, now there's different things with this. You know, Hebrew did not have a name for lightning. Okay. So when it talks about fire from heaven, it's probably referring to lightning. We like to make the big, you know,
a volcano erupted over here,
which is coming down, which is cool imagery, but. But I think that there's a reason, though, why you need maybe not hold that view, which is this, is that the beliefs of Baal was not just that he was the god of rain and thunder, but that he rode the lightning. So when it talks about whatever, you know, God favors more, you know, is the one true God, essentially, he was the superior God, by having lightning strike the altar of Elijah. And if Baal rides the lightning, then why is Baal?
That means Baal likes Yahweh more.
Why is Baal endorsing Yahweh?
Yeah.
You see how they're like, if Baal is going to ride the lightning and he's choosing Yahweh and choosing that altar,
yeah,
that is showing at the very least, even if it wasn't like, oh, we're monotheistic now,
mm-hmm.
to them, they're at least, but Yahweh's superior.
Yeah.
Which is what God is trying to do, right? So that's how he's able to go slay all the priests, 500 of them of Baal, and start kicking them out of Israel, right? Mm-hmm. That's what that whole showdown was. It's a polemic. God is using the beliefs to play
of another
out
people to play out his purpose,
play out his purpose to show his superiority over it. Right.
Yeah.
The crossing of the Red Sea, because you brought that up earlier. Mm-hmm. That's another example. There was a mythology within Egypt about using certain magic in the gods of being able to split water.
Oh, okay.
So there's a story where some of the magicians of Pharaoh, his daughter or somebody, I'm trying to remember it all, but his daughter or somebody had dropped like a necklace in the Nile River. And he's like, I really want that necklace back. Uh-huh. So he gets the magicians to split the water in two. So they were able to go out there, grab the necklace, give it back. Waters come back together.
Pastor had mentioned it. It was like the son of the Pharaoh had all of these women that would go out on the water with him to make him feel better because he was like sad or whatever. And then one of the women dropped the necklace.
Right.
And, so the guy was like, hey, split the water so we can get this necklace back to this pretty girl.
So now you have Egypt chasing the Hebrews. God splits not just the Nile, but now the entire Red Sea.
Yeah.
Right. He's using the whole idea of blotting out the sun, right, in Exodus.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they believe that the sun was Ra. One of their superior gods was Ra. They believe that, because this is just basic polytheistic belief, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that things happen in cycles. So every time the sun rays, that's Ra being born. And every time it sets, he's dying and going to the underworld. And there's this continuous cycle of that occurring, right? So by God,
that's really aggressive.
When Ra is coming up and he blots out the sun, the Egyptians would have said Ra is being blotted out,
mm-hmm.
which means that his new life is being stopped by Yahweh. So it's creating a sense of hopelessness to the Egyptians.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying? That's a polemic. That is mm-hmm. God taking beliefs and myths of the contemporaries of that region, and he is playing it out in history to show his superiority. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So
he's like, I'm God over all of this, all of that.
So what you see here with David and Goliath is what is a polemic. It's another example of this.
Wow. Okay.
It would have been understood then for the Philistine champion to come out and say, you bring your champion out, we're going to fight this, and see how he's mocking their God.
Mm-hmm.
The idea wasn't just simply, I'm the superior fighter. You know what I mean? The idea was more, my God is going to work and act through me. And your God's going to act and work through you. And we're going to fight this out. So it's not really a battle between David and Goliath. It's a battle between Yahweh and Dagon, who is the supreme God of Canaanite theology.
I think that that's interesting. At least this is what I'm hearing, is that of all of the Israelites? Yeah, the Israelites that were there. If that was the way that they thought, then none of them felt strong enough in their faith that God would actually go out and represent them in that combat.
And what you actually find is that Goliath had deeper conviction and faith into his God than any of the Israelites had in theirs.
Yeah.
Right? Isn't that sad? Except for David. Right? So when David goes out and says, I come equipped in the name of God.
Mm-hmm.
Right? He's saying, essentially, what this is not just a showdown of, you know, this... Because the other thing I think people get wrong, which is the exact opposite point the author is trying to make, is they think this is an underdog story of this little boy David fighting this giant.
Yeah.
And it's this big underdog story of God using the underdog. The reality of what is being painted is it is an underdog story. It's Goliath is the underdog because Goliath is the one representing a false God.
Mm-hmm.
David is representing the real God.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's any underdog in this story, it's Goliath.
Yeah.
The Israelites failed to see that, right? Mm-hmm. They completely missed the fact of using what David picked up on was the experience of God. Instead, they were looking so inward at themselves, my experience, my stature, my equipment compared to his.
At this point, they've already done the walking around the city seven times for seven
days.
That
was in Jericho. That was with Joshua. Yeah. Joshua was a couple hundred years before this.
Okay. Yeah.
They've had a history already of God.
Of God being faithful to them.
Right.
But if they also knew that they weren't being faithful to God, and it's like, well, it's like, is God even going to come to my defense, to my people's defense in this moment because I'm doing all these things wrong, or we as a people are doing all these things wrong? Like kind of like in Judges, it's like they were doing all this stuff wrong and God kind of turned away and then raised up a judge to confront that thing that they were doing wrong.
Yeah, you know? They could have. However, there is a story in 1 Samuel chapter 5. And I'm going to save it for right now because I want to get into the actual battle itself that this is going to feed into.
Okay.
But they had more recent experiences and knowledge of God defeating Dagon. Okay. Mm-hmm. So if I could just make a little point about polemics though, because a lot of people, you know, like I'm reading this, I'm like, this just makes so much more sense to me now, right? Like this is everything that I've been, like when you just study yourself, you're like, this is where I was going, right? I just didn't have, and a lot of people, and I even had this thought too, and just being an honest skeptic, is that this all is great, but why isn't this believed by most? Why isn't it understood? Why isn't this taught? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As much as it should. Like I'm able to, obviously there's enough people who are writing books about it within academia, but
it's not becoming the common perspective.
Right. Why is that the case? Right. And what I found is particularly with, when it comes to the land of Cana, we knew nothing really about the Canaanites and their religion up until about 1930.
Oh, really?
And we didn't even really know anything then. What happened, the big event that happened then was that it's called the Ugarit text. They found a series of about 20,000 tablets that were all within their massive temple library that was in northern Syria. Okay. Which geographically, I just want you to kind of follow how this aligns, right? We talk about the Philistines and we talk about these other people, but they were all united under one actual kingdom. So they had a people, but they were part of a larger kingdom, the Canaanite kingdom. Okay.
Okay.
So they find about 20,000 tablets, what they call the Ugarit text, in about, it was like 1928 or 29. It took about 30 years for them to translate all of them. Okay. So that puts you about what, 1960s ish, right?
Yeah.
Once it's translated, that's when it starts finally getting looked at by scholars and academia to start understanding just basic Mesopotamian history, right? So that takes about another 30 years for that to kind of get understood.
Yeah.
So it's not until about 1990 that you actually see some biblical scholars looking at this to understand references to scripture. But up until that point, the only reference we had of anything Canaanite in terms of religion was what we got from the Bible.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, okay. So you hear of Dagon, you hear of Baal, Astaroth, all of them. We knew nothing about them outside of the biblical text. Some of the things we learn is that, well, there's a couple of things. One, you see God's providence playing at the time that the Israelites are brought out of Egypt into the land of Cana, which is in the south of this little empire. Ugarit was the capital of the Canaanite kingdom, which was in like all the way up in northern Syria. Okay. So the northern side was where the capital was. So this, we're talking about the southern part of a kingdom. What's happening, what we learn is at the same time Joshua is entering into the land of Cana, you have what they call the sea people who keep coming and raiding and pillaging the northern part of the kingdom.
Okay.
Now there's all these people have all sorts of conspiracy theories about who the sea people are because it's referenced. They're referenced to the, they're like, who are the sea people?
Well, that's way too far away. Could be just Rome or, no, I mean, I guess on the time, depends on the time.
Rome wasn't there yet. It was what most people actually agree with is
Rome
at that time.
Rome definitely not there yet.
No, it was the tribal Greeks. So even before Greece was really in a unified empire.
Yeah.
They're like all of these, a bunch of series of islands, right?
Yeah.
Like all those people, the sea people, they learned how to fare and they started raiding.
That was the big thing about Greece, is that they had a navy.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. They had learned and mastered this a little bit sooner. So in the northern part of the kingdom, they're getting raided and they're at war with the sea people.
Yeah.
At that same time, you got millions of Hebrews invading in the south. So if you, right, have this kingdom with your armies, and you're being invaded from the north and the south, what are you going to defend? Probably whatever's closest to your capital, which was in the north. So that left them really weak in the south.
Yeah.
So when God led them into the land of promise, he chose a time, you see what I'm saying? That was where they were the most weak and vulnerable make that successful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because if they would have chosen any other time, they would have been able to come down and crush them, right?
Yeah.
But they couldn't do that because of the sea people. You see what I'm saying?
They're all focused up to the north.
But we just learned that, right? A couple other things we learned about the Canaanite pantheon. So we hear about Dagon, we hear about Baal and Astaroth, all them. What we learn is Dagon was the supreme, the top god of Canaanite theology.
Okay.
Baal is like his son. So this is like Zeus and Apollo.
Okay.
Right. Jupiter, Mars. Like there's always like that supreme top
overarching
god
one
of the pantheon, right?
Yeah.
Dagon was the top dog within Canaanite belief. Okay.
Okay.
Why does that matter? Because after this whole series of events, you see this shift in biblical text that it no longer becomes about Dagon. It becomes about Baal.
Oh, interesting.
And Baal eventually becomes almost worshipped as the more supreme god within their mm-hmm. pantheon. Why did that happen? A lot of it has to do was over what we're seeing in 1 Samuel, God defeats Dagon.
Okay.
You see what I'm yeah. saying? Like, God is defeating Dagon, and then mm-hmm. he goes after his son. Then God defeats Baal, and then God starts to, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you see this progression of God defeating the Mesopotamian gods. Mm-hmm. He starts in Egypt. Now, as he defeats Egypt and rescues them out of Egypt and defeated those gods, he now shifts his war.
What's fascinating there is that it's like God's showing his power in a way that they would understand
mm-hmm.
and that they would also come to serve him. Because just going to them and saying, you know, it's like, God is Lord of all, you should worship him. Just like today, if you go to someone who doesn't believe in God and just say like, you know, there is a God, God is over all, you should worship him. They're gonna be like, I don't know what any of that means, right? So it's like, but here you're seeing how God's displaying his power and authority in a way that those people would understand. And it's, you see it in Egypt as well, when the Israelites are leaving, it's like God's displaying his power and authority and showing that I'm over all of these through all of the, what are the really bad things he does? It starts with a P. Where he brings like the plagues. That's the word I'm looking yeah. for. It's like through the plagues, he's showing how he is over
everyone, all the things, Egyptian gods.
Yep, exactly. Over that whole period. And then ultimately when he splits the Red Sea, it's like that kind of great showing of power there. So it's like, he's showing who he is.
Moses
in a
using
way,
his staff.
Exactly.
Because he's showing who he big is. To Egypt.
Yeah. Egypt theology.
If you ever look at the hieroglyphics, all the pharaohs all have a staff.
Yeah, and it's all it's pointed out. And it's kind of in the same way.
There's three different
kinds
of staffs
imagery.
Within Egyptian belief, each one having different precedent. What's interesting is God gives Moses the least of the staffs within Egyptian belief.
And so, does the most with it.
And he does the most with it, playing out their myths in history using the least of the rods. Like, that's what I'm saying. It's God trolling them. Yeah. He just, yeah. I'm trolling your gods. When he says, I am a jealous God, this is what he means. He's like, I'm going to defeat all of them, right?
Yeah.
He starts with Egypt, goes to Cana, right? Then he starts taking out the Greeks. And then when you get to Jesus' times and the first century church, mm-hmm. you see him attacking
out-cycling the
Romans, right? Like, it's just, but there's also a scary warning that we're going to see here with Goliath, right? Because a very astute young child of mine, when we were talking about this, asked a very fair question. Did God not love Goliath?
Ooh.
You see what I'm saying? So what was it about Goliath that essentially condemned him to this fate?
Yeah.
I think mocking God.
He was, but everybody was. Yeah. And in fact, worshiping other gods is a mocking of him, right? Like, really, if anything, you see a passionate zeal within Goliath. Like, Goliath would have been a great ally to have on the side of God's army.
Yeah.
Right, imagine a Goliath as zealous and passionate for Yahweh as he was for Dagon,
mm-hmm.
right? So there's a piece with it, and this is why the battle kind of matters.
All right, that's it for this week, and I'm so excited to get into this with you next week on Real Bible Stories. All right, so we're partnered with Palms Church in Twin Nine Palms, and if you'd like to ask us questions, please join us on our Facebook page, and all of those links are available in the description below. We cannot wait to engage with you and join with you again next week on the next episode of Real Bible Stories.